welcome to the second part of this this morning's symposium on With Liberty and Justice for All. I'm Bill Pretzer, the curator of political history here at the Henry Ford, and it's a great pleasure for me to help along this conversation amongst our four presenters this morning. In fact, a number of you are going to participate very dramatically in that conversation, because I'm going to start with the questions that you have all posed. And a number of them are really quite direct, factual, sort of expansions on ideas or that were raised this morning. And then there are a series of more larger questions about how this might translate in your classrooms. And we'll try to not only involve the panelists there, but maybe if members of the audience have an idea about how some of this can be translated into a classroom experiences, if you want to share that with the rest of us. We can all learn from this process. And then finally, there are a couple of you who have asked very broad philosophical questions about the current experience and the future of liberty and justice in the United States, and how we might think about it in the future. And so at the end of this conversation, we'll come to those broader questions. We will not take the full 45 minutes for this conversation. We're going to move it right along, because we know we're already significantly behind schedule, and everyone has other things to do today. But let me start with a question for Lonnie Bunch. Why doesn't Lyndon Johnson get more credit for getting the civil rights bills passed in Congress in the 1960s?
Oh, I think Lyndon Johnson does get a lot of credit. Most of the scholarship really puts Lyndon Johnson as the pivotal figure of making much of this happen. I think part of what happens, however, is that when we translate this to the general public, often we see the civil rights movement as simply a black movement. And I think that sometimes leaves out the effective conversation, not only of Lyndon Johnson, but of the array of allies that participated in this struggle. And in some ways, the early success of the civil rights movement was really this sort of wonderful equation that included politicians like Johnson, included young kids from all walks of life. And so in some ways, your question raises the real question of how do we teach the civil rights movement in a way that it's seen as a central American story, not as a central African American story.
Okay. A number of you this morning mentioned the international context in which these various movements took place and were influenced by occasions or events and theories developed overseas. And so, Eleanor, one of our audience members would like to know if the right to vote for women in the German Weimar Republic had any influence on the United States' development of women's suffrage.
You know, I really did not get into the Weimar Republic. In fact, I think that they got the vote after America did. The foreign country that had the greatest influence was Britain. It's funny to call Britain a foreign country, but since our roots come from Britain. But in fact, the feminist movement, the suffrage movement, was very active in Britain. A woman named Evangeline Pankhurst and her daughters. And it was much more aggressive in London than it was here. I mean, they would storm the parliament, and they would chain themselves here and there and throw their bodies across the streets. And it was their tactics that the more sedate suffragists in this country were afraid of. And that's why Carrie Chapman Catt was horrified when that inaugural parade when Wilson became president, when that disintegrated into violence. But that's where Alice Paul became radicalized, and she, you know, borrowed their tactics of confronting the party in power and not being accommodationist. And as I said, I mean, every movement, it seems to me, has the people who want to go slower and the people who want to go faster. You always need the people at the barricades so that you have something to push toward.
This issue of strategies and tactics has come up a number of times. And so, David Blight, do you believe Lincoln could have won the Civil War without the Emancipation Proclamation?
He could have if the Union had won more victories in the first 2 years. But of course, one of the principal reasons that Lincoln moves against slavery in 1862 is because the war developed much larger than originally anticipated, And he came to realize, as many others eventually did, that in order to win the war, they had to conquer Southern society and to basically destroy the social infrastructure of Southern society. It was the necessity of emancipation in great part that brought Lincoln to the issue, although in the end he is a willing emancipator. Could the Union have won without emancipation? No, not after 1862 into 1863. This is where events, the war on the ground, the way in which the war was being waged, and indeed what the South was fighting for to preserve, has to always be brought into this equation about Lincoln's place in emancipation or why emancipation came when it did. I'd only add to that that that's a fascinating question, because it's always contingent on when you ask it. Is it 1861? Is it 1863? Is it 1864? There is a sense, though, I think, in which in the broader public historical imagination in America, emancipation is now viewed as something, well, it was inevitable. I mean, of course America would free the slaves. To my students, I always remind them that the only emancipation in the entire era of modern emancipations in the 19th century, there were dozens of them, the only emancipation in all the world that happened in all-out total war was the one in the United States. In many other countries, emancipation came by legislation. I mean, that doesn't mean there wasn't struggle and even some bloody rebellion beforehand. But only in America did we end slavery in all-out total war. And one of the reasons for that is that we were a republic. The side that owned the slaves had the right to dissent. And I sometimes argue that the greatest dissent in American history is the Confederacy. It's the only group that's ever taken it to that extent. So again, it depends on when you ask that question, in which year. But in the end, I would say no.
It is bringing that sense of imagination. Gee, the Confederacy is a great dissent, and looking at things in new ways that so often prompts students to look at history, not as a set of given facts, but as something interesting and worth discussing. And a lot of it often has to do with hypotheticals and putting oneself in someone else's shoes. So, Jack Rakoff, if Jefferson and Hamilton were alive today, which would be more comfortable in today's political environment? There's a follow-up question, by the way, Jack.
Oh, God. Yeah, that's an interesting one. Well, I think it would follow from what I was implying, that we're living in a more Hamilton, in some ways we're living in a more Hamiltonian world. That's to say, I think especially the last 3 or 4 years have illustrated that in terms of how our constitutional system operates, the presidency does have certain kinds of decisive advantages, and it takes a lot more temerity on the part of, certainly on the part of Congress that it's demonstrated, and to some extent on the part of judiciary to be able to stand up to it. On the other hand, since I am a historian, I'm always allowed to qualify. I'm not one of those people who despairs that the success of the Bush administration in terms of developing and acting upon this theory of broad executive power is itself persuasive or even carrying the day. I mean, there's a lot of discussion, I think, among academics, among the kind of the rights community more generally as to whether or not, as to what is the relationship between civil rights in our culture and the experience of war. I think the net argument is that that over time, that successively, especially in the 20th century, but going back to the Civil War, that the experience of conflict and the experience of aspects of domestic repression has in fact sharpened our sensibilities and our sensitivity, and has also created interest groups or created professional communities as well, which have a much stronger commitment to the protection of fundamental rights than would have been true earlier. Much of the history of the suffrage, I'm sure Eleanor does this book, but also my friend Alex Kazar in his book on the right to vote argues, there are two stories you can tell about how the suffrage expands in American history. One is there was an egalitarian ideal is embedded in our history from the beginning, with the Declaration of Independence, and it just progressively gets broader and broader with some nasty episodes like the Civil War to advance it. The other story says actually that there have always been somewhat reactionary forces. There have been numerous movements to retrench the suffrage as well as to enlarge it. That was especially true in the late 19th and early 20th century with the advent of immigration. By the way, today marks the 100th anniversary. I was thinking about this when Lonnie was talking about whenever we came here. Today is literally the 100th anniversary of the arrival of my grandfather at Ellis Island. I happened to discover this only within the last month, so it turns out to mean a lot to me. Anyhow, the enlargement of the suffrage has often taken place in response to and kind of fulfillment of the promise of war. Certainly, I think any federal judge today, whether an Alito or a Breyer, has as a reference point for a norm of judicial behavior what the court did or what the court became complicit in doing in the Japanese internment cases during World War II. I mean, to me, I think it's very hard to imagine any federal judge today being oblivious to the lessons and of the Korematsu case and the Hirabayashi case, the other related cases, and not having some understanding that the importance of stepping up and subjecting executive action to judicial scrutiny.
Follow up on that issue of executive action and executive authority. Isn't it true that executive authority has been growing at least since Lincoln's dilution of the Habeas Corpus Act during the Civil War? That is, we can't trace the growth of executive authority simply to the last couple of administrations or three or four.
No, I mean, obviously not, though. I think I would put it less in response to Lincoln than more in terms of the rise of the presidency of the 20th century. Because after all, Lincoln is followed by a number of weak presidents, including Andrew Johnson, who's impeached and should have been but was not quite convicted. Most of the late 19th century presidents are a fairly forgettable group. Be hard-pressed for, many academics, much less, most of your students, to come up with any of them as household names. So I think it's much more of a 20th century thing. I mean, Lincoln is always hot, but Lincoln is hot these days because the emergency issues surrounding the Civil War resemble, in some ways, though they differ in others, the ones we've been thinking about since 9/11.
There's also been a distinct group of historians, quite conservative, many of them really libertarians, in recent years. There's a whole subgenre of Lincoln scholarship that blames Lincoln for big government. That it's during the Civil War where this strong federal government emerged, and it's really a vilification literature. They've just gone after Lincoln. It's all his fault. It of course emerged out of the emergencies of war. There's also a liberal scholarship on Lincoln now. Daniel Farber wrote a recent book called Lincoln's Constitution that takes Lincoln on and does argue that only on the habeas corpus issue, his suspension of habeas during the war, can you really fault him in terms of constitutional excess. But he does conclude that locking up 3,000 or 4,000 people without any rights is something presidents ought not do.
Yeah, I must say I view that as a really negative mark on his record and his character. Is it defensible? I mean, I assume it's not defensible.
Well, but I would have thought there's isn't it? I thought there's
for lawyers there's always a defense.
Right. Okay.
You go.
I thought there's an issue of what Lincoln does prior to when Congress comes back into session, and then when Congress ex post authorizes or supports his suspension of habeas corpus in the immediate period after the outbreak of the Civil War.
Yeah.
If I pulled out my text here, the prohibition on the suspension, the clause regulating the suspension of habeas corpus implies that it's essentially a congressional duty or responsibility or power. And I think, in a general sense, that's probably right. But as at least one of my colleagues likes to argue, let's imagine a situation not unlike April or May 1861 or before Congress is back in session, where there is insurrection in the country and the very possibility of Congress meeting might be impeded by the existence of rebellion. Would the president not have some kind of necessitarian authority to suspend habeas corpus in order to get legal government back up and running?
And of course, there were a range of offenses. There were efforts in certain regions, parts of Ohio and whatnot, to organize legitimate resistance groups to the federal government to stop the Union war effort. But then there were the people who were actually arrested for what abusive language toward the president, just derogatory language toward the president. which we do have a Bill of Rights. So it's,
Eleanor, why do you think historians have focused so much more on Susan B. Anthony and Elizabeth Cady Stanton than on Alice Paul and her contemporaries?
That's a very good question, because while Anthony and Stanton really did get it going for much of their 50-year partnership, they really didn't make all that much of an impact, and it was their successors who really drove it through to a conclusion. Maybe it's just the length of time. I mean, it was 50 years versus, if you look at the Alice Paul, it's 1911, and she's basically dealing in a few years. And maybe historians like to have more records to pick over. And you could look at Anthony's relationship with a succession of presidents. I mean, she was invited to the White House quite regularly, and the presidential politics played off of her. So I guess that would be my explanation.
And I think also, I think you're right, I think it's also tied to the notion of the fact that you can use their lives into a lens into so many different aspects of the period, because they lived so long, and because they could comment on different presidents, different notions of race, of suffrage. So I think all of that gives historians sort of, that's the first group to go.
Richer tapestry, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, in a way, Alice Paul was like a meteor.
Right.
And although she lived a very long life and did go on to actually write the Equal Rights Amendment, mm-hmm. and to lobby for that, but she never, her impact was really never visible, mm-hmm. after the passage of the amendment.
Well, let's follow up with that. The next question is, Eleanor, why has the women's movement so stalled as far as the ERA and glass ceilings in the workplace and equal pay for equal work movements?
I went to an 80-something birthday party for Betty Friedan last summer, and she was asked, where is the women's movement going next? And she paused for quite a long time, and she's rarely at a loss for words. And she finally just threw up her hands and said, "We did it." I think it's really hard to extend the suffrage movement into the future. I mean, I look at my own career. I mean, I'm a product of the contemporary women's movement of the 1970s. It's not contemporary to many young people today, but it is in my mind. And they really opened the doors professionally for women. And the Equal Rights Amendment, which surfaced right around the same time, I suppose, was so balkanized into a battle between women on the right and on the left, and it became a sort of a fight over whether we would have unisex bathrooms. And I also think it did give rise to a kind of political woman that feminists had not really thought existed anymore, and the rise of the right, which has become so active in the right to life movement and some of the culture wars, and they're really, I think, have a dominant voice today on the national stage, whereas, you know, feminists are, you know, have that sort of look of yesterday about them. And I think you couldn't get young women interested in the Equal Rights Amendment, because by the time that really came to fruition, the doors were opening everywhere. And I think young women felt like, what were the rights they didn't have? I think once they get out into the workplace and into the world, they see those barriers they didn't see before. But there is no yearning today for a movement sisterhood. And you look at the contemporary literature, you have you know, one book out by Kate Michelman, the former head of NARAL, basically recouping, it's a memoir of the, you know, the need for, you know, reproductive rights and that whole driving issue of so much of the women's movement. And then you have Kate O'Byrne from the right saying, feminists and women, how women make it worse. And we're now really at a stage in our societal development now where we're worried about men. And women are the dominant group in colleges, and you know, boys aren't succeeding in schools. And so, you know, I think these things have cycles. But right now, it'd be hard for me to identify any kind of you know, feminist or women's movement to say what it is and where it's going.
Lonnie, you brought up the issue of the segregation of schools. Is it time to go back to a 1960s style forced busing to integrate schools?
I think the challenge, I mean, God, there's so many people working on schools, and I think the real issue is to think about, one, answering the question of whether integration is really essential to helping the public schools be successful. If the argument is yes, then it means a variety of steps and practices that lead us in that direction. If the answer is no, then it leads us into other directions in terms of the elongated day, in terms of the kind of support network you provide for African American students or for minority students who dominate in these schools. I think the real question from where I sit is, how do you make sure that many of the public schools do not just produce a lost generation? I mean, I was struck by talking to my daughters who are 22 and 18, talking about, even in their educational experience, how few of the black males are really doing credible in the kinds of schools that they went to, and how it really raised the question, almost as you were saying about men generally, what happens to the black males if the largest numbers of those are ending up incarcerated, ending up dropping out of schools? So I think the question really is, what's the best way to strengthen those schools?
Jack, if congressional action is, as you say, more cumbersome than executive authority, how does the role of lobbyists, so much in the news recently, further complicate congressional decision making, and what can we do about it? Never ask an historian what we can do about it.
Well, you know, money is like water and flows around anything and everything you could put in its way. As an 18th century historian, there's not much I could say about contemporary lobbyists. I mean, I will say something about Congress. It's the obvious, you know, point in my talk that I think the real crisis in American constitutionalism at the moment, is, assuming as I do that this notion of unchecked, inherently discretionary authority is quite dangerous, is to get Congress to step up to the plate and to do what it's supposed to do. That's to say, I have no opinion as to how we ought to treat the detainees in Guantanamo on the merits. I mean, that's to say, should they have access to federal courts? I don't think we should torture them for a whole array of reasons. I don't think we can allow presidents to make up strategy and make up procedures as they go along, year in, year out, without having effective oversight, and I think without having effective authority delegated. To me, this whole business about the signing statement with which Judge Alito was so prominently associated from his earlier career as a in the Reagan Justice Department, it's a very interesting and in some ways a very disturbing development. I mean,
start with what I said.
The Constitution says the president shall take care that the laws be faithfully executed.
The president feels that.
Well, I seem to be going on and off here. If
the president feels
that the law is a pending measure is unconstitutional, his duty is to veto it on constitutional grounds. And this has been weighed ever since George Washington considered whether or not he should veto the bank bill back in 1791. Andrew Jackson had his own way of thinking about this. That's the president's remedy to this kind of situation. If a measure is repassed, then you have to ask the question, why do we have a limited veto as opposed to an absolute veto? That's to say, why can Congress override a veto? Why isn't the president just allowed a veto? And at that point, the discussion is over. The basic answer is, in the 18th century, the collective judgment of Congress, at least if you could get a supermajority, would have been thought of as being legally and constitutionally superior to the residual objections of a president. So the president's allowed to make his case, but in the end, if Congress, speaking on behalf of popular majorities or supermajorities, felt that case was not persuasive and could muster two-thirds majorities in both houses, then the president's wisdom had to defer. One other aspect we mentioned here from coming out of the English legacy is one of the traditional prerogative powers of the king was the power to suspend law, which means that if the king didn't feel a given law should be enforced on particular occasions, it was part of his prerogative to declare the law suspended. Colonial governors could do this as well. There's no room for suspension in an American conception of take care that the laws be faithfully executed. There's no room for it in the 18th century. My position is there's no room for it today. Problem, of course, is you have to get Congress to do what it's supposed to do. That's, and of course, when Congress and the president come from the same party, there are political incentives complicate the institutional difficulties of getting two houses of Congress to agree on a strategy. Best you could say, Republicans are starting to get nervous about re-election, and John McCain seems to be something of an independent voice on a lot of these issues. And if Bush tells him my interpretation of the McCain Amendment is it still allows me to torture, I don't think McCain is going to lie down on this, and I think we'll hear more from him. But it's always an uphill struggle to get consensus within Congress and get consensus between both houses.
So we come back to that theme of struggle is inevitable. That's the only thing that's inevitable. I'd like to end this session by asking each of you to put yourselves in the shoes of an upper L or middle school teacher, and what is one thing you might do or suggest to bring home or to engage your students in your particular interest or in the topics that you've dealt with today? And I guess for this, I'll go in chronological order. So, Jack, it's back to you. How does one deal with the constitutionalism in a middle school class? One idea.
Middle school is tough because if I were to deal with it, I know you guys are out in the trenches, to use the familiar metaphor. You know, Dave and I both do workshops for high school teachers every summer, and I know the kinds of things you struggle with. Nevertheless, I think if you put any text in front of a student, whether it's the text of the Constitution, or I would say take the debate, I think it's August 18, 1787, which is the famous debate over the war power. You know, what is it? Why does the Constitutional Convention substitute the verb declare for the verb make in the war power clause? I think if you bone up on it in advance and you're prepared to go through it line by line, word for word, those kinds of sources are teachable, and they will illuminate a lot. So, you know, it's 18th century English can be a little strange to us, but it's relatively modern by comparison to some previous centuries. I think if you prepare for it, you can explain what was being debated and why it was an issue. And you can get the students to see the language of the Constitution is not simply a dry text. It was the product of thoughtful analysis.
Great, thank you. David.
Well, you may not have asked the right people on this, but I did spend 7 years in some of those trenches. So I would say first start by going to these events and then go to summer institutes. Do everything you can do first for your own intellectual lives. I would have killed to go to these kinds of things in the 1970s when I was a public school teacher. They didn't even have summer institutes. The NEH institutes hadn't even been invented yet. Which says how old I am. But then, which is the trend now everywhere, you all know this, as Jack just suggested, teach with documents. I teach with documents all the time. It's the central pedagogical thread of the Summer Institute that I do at Yale every year for teachers about abolitionism. And then, you know, as a general principle, whether I knew I was doing it or not, whether I was self-conscious of it or not early on, you teach with story. You find, I mean, if you've only got a week to do this or 2 days to do that, you all know this. You teach with stories sometimes. You place them somewhere. You place them in a point-counterpoint, in a conflict, in a story with some kind of protagonist, a story with a few characters like Eleanor has laid out here, where they can see the tensions of these struggles in history. And if you leave them with nothing else, you're leaving them with a sense of history, how history actually happens. There's nothing really inevitable about it. There was this cause, and there was that cause, and there was that force at play, and this force at play. Well, in the end, which were most important? But it's within the context of some kind of narrative. We're probably all hardwired for narrative. I mean, I don't know that. The neuroscientists are working on this as we speak, spending billions in grant money to figure out whether we really are narrative creatures, and if that's the way our memory works. We probably are. And your kids are wired for narrative, story. If you can teach out of a story, but always knowing ahead of time, as you've boned up, as Jack says, where I want to take them. Not that the political outcome, not to an ideological outcome, but to a historic, an outcome that's a historical understanding. So I, you know, documents and story, and come to all these things you can.
Thank you.
I actually think suffrage is easy, thanks to HBO and the fact that they did this wonderful movie starring Hillary Swank as Alice Paul, and. My book, Founding Sisters, is a small book, and it is told as a story. And I think you really can get kids interested in this subject. The suffragists needed a makeover, and I did part of it. And HBO went all the way. I mean, they make Alice Paul into this sexy creature, and I think that's fine because again, it opens the door, it makes it accessible. Also, you can ask students if they have grandparents, if they have any memories in the family of people who were actually involved in any of these movements, and to get the personal stories. And there is a, in Washington, I've this one public school teacher who he came to one of my book signings and he invited me to his class. And what he does is it's March Madness, and it's like the basketball games. And he has the students all assume a character from history, and they research it, and they make a presentation. They pretend they're that person. And they have playoffs until they decide to get the most important person of the 20th century. And and he invites local people in, like myself, as judges. And the Alice Paul character actually won in this one semester, but it really gets them involved. And this is not a private school. This is a public school with a primarily Hispanic and African American population. Hispanic, where their English is not their first language, and it's really, I mean, I sit there, I have tears in my eyes. I am so moved by their excitement and this teacher's excitement. His name is Cosby Hunt, and he's just a fantastic, energetic teacher, and it really shows. And he provides pretzels and chocolate chip cookies, too. That also helps. Makes it a game.
I think that my initial training was in slavery, and I remember just how much I discovered by reading the slave narratives. But I wished I could have talked to slaves. The luck of the civil rights movement is that while many people are gone, there's an awful lot of people in almost every community that either was involved, supported it, or fought against it. And I think there's a great opportunity to pull those people into your schools and have the kids engage with living people who tell that story in many ways that you know better than I. Not only does that make it real, but it gives them the sort of counterpoints to begin to understand that conflict and decisions and choices are really what shapes history.
Great, thank you all. We heard about as a teacher, your intellectual development. We heard about the uses of primary sources, about employing stories, about the exceptional opportunities we now have to use all kinds of media. Some of us remember film strips, but now there's obviously much more effective media, and we all talk about how important media can be in influencing ways of young people thinking and imagining. We've talked about personal connections and then this opportunity to use oral history. All of those, I think, are opportunities that are now quite well rooted in a number of areas of scholarship and teaching. David Blight also mentioned NEH teacher workshops, and I hasten to add that the Henry Ford this coming summer will sponsor 2 weeks of an NEH-sponsored Landmarks of American History workshop for teachers, K through 12, on America's Industrial Revolution, using the sites in Greenfield Village. And those workshops happen at about 20 sites around the country. So I do encourage you to look into the National Endowment for the Humanities and ask about their workshops. At this time, I'd like to thank all of you for coming and ask you to join me in a great round of applause for our panelists.